Accession number 9857, Reel 2.
Yes, I was saying that David Stafford, in this article in the Slavic Review, refers to a memoir by Sir Cecil Parrott, who was the tutor to King Peter in the 1930s, who says that there would certainly have been no coup d'etat if the British had not planned it.
Not true. We had nothing whatever to do with the coup d'etat. Bora Milkovich was the man who organized it and carried it out and put Simovich in because Bora Milkovich was too junior to do it himself. And anyway, he was not a politician, while Simovich was.
There was a man called Terence Schoen.
Oh, Terence Schoen was the minister in Cairo.
Did you meet him?
Oh, I saw a lot of him. And he came to me in the embassy. See, my younger brother was at Bletchley. My younger brother speaks even better German than I do. He's still living. And actually, he was with the cipher. He was doing the deciphering of the German signals at Bletchley. And the day that the order went out from Hitler to attack Yugoslavia, my younger brother sent off on his own responsibility a signal to us in Belgrade to say that the Germans would attack on the 6th of April, I think it was. And we pass this message on to Bora. And Bora said, nonsense. Now, Terence Schoen had come up with Sir John Dill in a Lockheed 12 belonging to Lord Forbes, who was air attaché Athens. Sir John Dill didn't succeed in persuading Simovich even to establish a means of signal communication. Nothing at all. He got no change out of Simovich. So he went back. Anthony Eden, with Sir John Dill and Terence Schoen, had been in Ankara before. Again, Churchill's program to try and bring the Turks in on our side, which they failed to do. They got back to Athens. We got a signal from the Foreign Office saying Anthony Eden and Sir John Dill wanted to come up to, with Terence Schoen, to Belgrade. The reply came at once. Everybody knows what that chap with the hat looks like. We don't want him here. Sir John Dill will be all right. So they arrived in the Lockheed 12, and I was invited to go with my two cars and collect him from the airfield at Zemun. I put him in the big 25 and waited for Forbes to get out of his aircraft, which he did in uniform. And the Yugoslav Air Force commander of the station came up to me. He said, "Tell that chap to get back at once into his aeroplane and take off his uniform. If he comes in here, we have to put him in arrest." Because, of course, Yugoslavia wasn't yet in the war. Forbes argued for a minute, and then he did what he was told, and I drove him over. Sir John Dill spent the night with me, and the following day, having got no satisfaction from Simovich, left again with Forbes for Athens, leaving Terence Schoen Are you... Is this working?
Yes, we're still working.
So, Terence asked me to arrange for an aircraft to take him away. I arranged for a Rapide. I'd sold de Havilland Rapides to the Aeroport, to the airline, and I arranged for this to be ready to take him. We got the signal saying that Belgrade would be bombed on the Saturday at 7 in the morning. Terence came to me, he said, "Tom, for heaven's sake, I'll be just getting into my aeroplane to leave when the Stukas arrive. Do something." So I got into a car, went over to Zemun, to Bora, and said, "Bora, please, can't you do something to help? Because it won't be fun in a Rapide going down to so on." "Yeah, of course." So he rang the managing director of Aeroport and told him to provide a Lockheed to take Terence Schoen down to Athens, down to Salonika. I went back and said, "Terence, at 2 o'clock this afternoon, please be at the airfield and ready to take off, because I got you at 12, Lockheed 12. I then went to my home in the hills to my Serbian wife, who had taken a Red Cross course and said, "If Yugoslavia is going to be in the war, we'll be in the mountains and I'm going to be a nurse. I've got my Red Cross certificate." I said, "At present, you are leaving on this aircraft at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Pack a bag, take the 100 Napoleon d'Or." I'd given her and her mother each 100 Napoleon d'Or in case they were hung up during the war. And she said, "No, I'm not going." Now, we have in Yugoslavia in those days our stoves, all these big stoves which you fed with wood. I walked over to the basket with the senator, picked up a lump, and I said, "Look here, you're going, conscious or unconscious now, all right, if I can take my dog." So I said, "You will take your dog." I drove her across, and as we got out of the car at the aircraft, Terence Schoen came over and said, "Tom, dogs are not allowed to fly, are they?" I said, "Good God, you can stay behind if you like. It's my bloody aeroplane, you see." So Vanna and he and the two daughters of the foreign minister, deputy foreign minister, got into the aircraft on the way there. But the pilot said, "My orders are to go to Salonika." I said, "You know what the situation is. If you don't get a signal at Salonika telling you to return, you go on with the whole party to Athens." So, of course, he knew damn well he couldn't get a signal, and he went on and took them on to Salonika.
So they got
to Athens.
They got there safely.
Huh?
They got there safely.
They got?
They got there safely.
Oh, yes. When I arrived in my Dornier 17 from Niksic, there was my wife in the Yugoslav legation in Athens with her dog waiting in the hall for me. And 2 days later, I'd shipped 600 Yugoslavs in a Port Halifax, the cargo ship, off to Alexandria. We run the shuttle, you see, and Bora Milkovic and his brother and my Serbian partner, Krstic, came out on the last Savoia, which the Greeks shot down. And Bora got both his legs broken and an arm broken. They carried him right down to Kalamata in the south of Greece, and a destroyer took them on and brought them to Alexandria.
What did you think of the Yugoslav military performance against the Germans? Did it take you by surprise or not?
You see, under the regime before, previous regime, before the coup d'etat, the Yugoslav forces were disposed incorrectly. They were sent up largely into Slovenia and on the Hungarian frontier. So they were not properly disposed, and Colonel Mihailovich, who'd lost seniority 6 months for anti... There were a lot of Germans in Yugoslavia, you know, with farming and so on, over above and over Sad. Mihailovich had trouble and lost 6 months' seniority for anti-German action, program was that if Yugoslavia was invaded, he would take over anti-German action in the mountains, you see. Well, of course, he never really got going. Only in Serbia was it all right, but a lot of First War generals put on their uniform and came out and said, "We want to command, we are going to be in this sort of thing." It was an absolute shambles. Some action was taken by them, and some of them... Now, this is interesting. Yugoslav military code permits cooperation with the enemy if if thereby they can establish a situation which will enable them to turn the tables. One or two generals who were in the western, southwestern part of the country, in Bosnia and so on, did take such action, but Mihailovich never.
Did you know a British arms dealer in Yugoslavia called Julius Hannon?
Yes, of course. He was SOE or something of the kind, I don't know.
Can you tell me about how you came into contact with him? What you
well,
knew
I would
about
have
him?
Nothing to do with him. He was a South African Jew. I'm not necessarily anti-Semitic, but I was certainly not a personal friend of Hanno's. In fact, I established with an American called Shellins a lovely flat. I went up to Vienna and bought some lovely mahogany furniture and that sort of thing, and we had a first-class flat and entertained quite a lot. Julius and Rebecca would come, his wife, to our party, naturally. We had quite a few parties, cocktail parties and that sort of thing, and Rebecca was criticizing us, saying, "You two bachelors trying to run an establishment like this, it's nonsense, you're being robbed and everything." So George Shillin said, "Nonsense. You keep accounts, we keep accounts, we keep the number of guests we have and what they have and so forth for a month, and I bet you £5 that ours will be lower than yours, or lower costs." Of course, that was an insult to a woman, you see. So the bet was made. What she didn't know was that George would go up to Novi Sad once a week or so and have a lamb or a pig or something killed. He had had experience before coming to Europe as a butcher trainee, and he knew exactly how to deal with it. So our meat was costing us about a tenth of what she was paying. We won the bet. That was all I knew about Hanno. Hanno died in Cairo. He died in Cairo during the war.
Who was this chap Schilling?
Schellens. He was an employee of the Saccone, the Standard Oil.
And did you know an engineer called Bill Bailey?
Yes, he was first class. He stayed on, you know. Bill Bailey stayed on for a long time after the occupation of Yugoslavia by the Germans.
Why do you say he was first class?
Well, he was a tough one, and I had nothing to do with him, but I'm quite sure that the record of Bill Bailey would be first class. I'm quite sure.
But did you know anything about the activities he was undertaking?
No.
You were talking about...
You understand why?
Why you didn't have anything to do with secret operations?
Because I always looked forward to returning to Yugoslavia at the end of the war, and I wasn't going to allow anybody to say that I'd been a spy. Quite simple.
You were talking earlier on about Tom Masterson. Did you know anything about Masterson's attitude towards what Hanno was doing in Yugoslavia?
No, I know.
What do you think of these allegations that Mikovic was an agent of the British?
Well, totally untrue. He was deadly honest. And as I think I told you, after the war, there he was living on £3 a week in Lime Grove. Deadly honest. You see, the Serbs, all Serbs, you know the history of Serbia, don't you? A little.
Only a little.
Well, when the Turks invaded Europe, the Serbs went on fighting for Christianity against the Turks. They would be impaled on stakes, but they wouldn't give up their religion. Deadly loyal. The Turks went on into Croatia. Are you a Holy Roman?
No.
That's all right. Because in my experience, although you see there, my daughter with the Pope, she's gone Holy Roman. My experience has been always that if the poor Mur Sauté, if the a Roman Catholic, finds it suitable to hide in over his religion, he will do so. Now, the Croats even provided the finest troops to fight against the Serbs in the First War. The Croatians were part of the Austro-Hungarian army, and all the... I had a picture in my house in Belgrade of rows of gibbets in which the Croats were hanging the population during the First War. So there would be no question about the Serbs, and this is why I was so anxious to get as many of them out as I possibly could, because they would always be loyal, you see, while the Croat would be double-crossing.
Now, you were talking about when you were leaving Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
Can you tell me again?
Driving with the convoy from the 17 cars from the embassy, the legation in Belgrade, down to Dubrovnik, over the mountain pass, I had... I was a little bit tired. I only got an hour and a half and 2.5 hours sleep in 10 days. I couldn't stop talking. So coming down into Sarajevo and decided to leave the big car to have a repair done, and went on to Ilidje for the night, driving back to collect the big car, and driving out, there was on the side of the road my brother-in-law and the governor of Croatia. And I said, come on, get inside. We're going on to Dubrovnik and Kotor. I don't know what the future is, but don't stay here. My brother-in-law turned to the governor and said, what's your plan? And the governor said, I'm not going to leave the country. They went back to Zagreb. They were thrown into prison. 10 days later, they were shot by the Ustashi. My brother-in-law was killed. He was Orthodox, you see. And that my wife, Anna, who I picked up from Athens and flew on in my Dornier back to Egypt, finally, at the end of the war, asked me to get her mother out from Yugoslavia, and I sent her off to Bari, and her mother was released and carried to Bari and came to Cairo at a little flat which she stayed in, and said, what's all this? I came out for you, Tom, as much as I did for Vanna. What's the idea? Oh, I said, Vanna says she wants to go to America, and I can't go, of course, and our marriage appears to be over. And she said, nonsense. My mother-in-law said, nonsense. Throw your knee and spank her. And I said, I'm sorry, they don't educate us in that way. So my wife went away. I divorced her. We were married in an Orthodox church, and I was able to divorce her in her. And then the man who was the intervener was the deputy naval attaché of the American embassy. He was a multimillionaire. And when they got to New York, there was a law there that if one of the spouses was in a mental home, there was no divorce. So he could never get his divorce. He drank himself to death, and he's left my dear wife breeding dogs. She comes over for Cruft show sometimes. And she's got these Scotties, and that's the end of that story.
Going back to Sir Ronald Campbell, what were Campbell's own relationships with the air attaché, MacDonald?
Not very friendly. Who would think of sending a MacDonald in as an air attaché to a Campbell who is the minister? What nonsense. Do you see what I mean?
You mean the massacre of Glencoe?
Yes. Yeah.
But on a personal basis, the relationship was strained, was it?
They're not friends, no. And MacDonald was asked by Campbell to go up to Nixitch to fly out to Greece, and he declined. He said he wouldn't go. And that's why I was sent.
Is it true that Campbell didn't know about your contacts with Mikovic?
He must have known.
Why do you say he must have known?
I had no relations, really, with any big leader in Yugoslavia. When MacDonald was sent to contact the coup d'etat government, he came back with his tail between his legs and said he wasn't admitted to the building. So I was asked to accompany him, and we, as we passed every picket on the road, most of the pickets were Air Force personnel, they would salute me, and I would take MacDonald in. MacDonald had no real knowledge of what was going on at all, as far as I could see. But mind you, if he was getting fed by SOE or somebody, that wouldn't have been passed to me. I was assistant air attaché only for 10 days. You see, before that I was honorary attaché, and I just would, every week, I would take the intelligence summary and translate it from Serb to English, and they would all make up their own. But McDonnell knew damn well that it was I who was getting it.
Now, leaving Yugoslavia and going to the First World War, can you tell me about how you came to join the Royal Flying Corps? How you came to join the Royal Flying Corps?
Yes. I had been for 3 years, from 1911 to 14, in Hamburg with the Continental Agents of Jardine Masons of China as an English correspondent. The Germans paid me to learn German, most unusual. I used to give lessons, Berlitzvertod, in English to the Germans. They would pay me, and we would, Berlitzvertod, looking up the dictionary, I would learn German and they would learn their English, you see. Well, I had organized, they had a rugby match, a team from Hanover and a team from Berlin, and I got in touch with the organizers. They were a man short for the Berlin team, and I played for Berlin against Hamburg, against Hanover in this demonstration match. From there, we had a meeting in a cafe and we formed Der Hamburger Rugby Club. We got three teams going in the end. We had one German in. My scrum half, I had to play fly half because I've always been a hospital chap and I was ready to draw my man and pass always, you see. But of course, strictly speaking, I was not really a half. But at the end of the season, we decided that we must stick together. Now, in Hamburg before the war, there were five British banks: Hong Kong, Shanghai, Chartered Bank, British Bank of South America, Bank of South Africa. They all had one or two British public school lads for 12 months prior to going out to China and so on. And that's how we formed the rugby club. Now, we'd all got together over the rugby club and we thought, well, damn shame. What are we going to do in the summer? We decided we'd have a British eight. So we formed 60 of us, joined in Hamburg. Favorita Harmonia, the best rowing club, and we had a British eight and a British four. We won a race in the Kiel Regatta. They murdered the Archduke. I took my scrum half, who was a great friend, and went down to the Consul General Hearn, and remembered his name now, and said, please, what do you advise us to do? He said, I'm not allowed to give you advice. So I said, well, excuse me if I put it another way. If you were in my place at 21, what would you do? He said, get out as quick as you can. So my scrum half and I